Well, guys, it may be that this may be the most famous story in the entire Old Testament. Everybody has heard about David and Goliath. The problem is that most of the time, people get the point of the story wrong. Most of the time, when this text is presented, the message is that you need to be strong, and you need to be bold, and you need to be courageous like David. And when your giants approach, when your problems approach, you need to go to your nearby brook and you need to take your 5 smooth stones, which is usually like something like Bible reading and prayer and meditation, and you need to swing them at your giant and strike them down because you're David. That's what people say. But that's not the point of the passage, as we're about to find out. To understand the real message of 1 Samuel 17, we need to remember the context. The utter need of a righteous king. Ever since we heard from Judges, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. We've been waiting for a righteous king. When is he gonna show up? And we have seen that the coming of this king has 2 individuals in view. Number one, a momentary king, and that is the person we're about to be introduced to today. One who would solve the problem, the momentary problem of Israel. And secondly, an ultimate king, Christ. Christ, an ultimate king of whom David is merely a type and a picture of, right? And so for this ultimate king, we have understood that the momentary king, David, has to come first. So this chapter that we're about to study today is incredibly important because it presents to us the introduction of David as this momentary king that we've been waiting for. Chapter 16 introduced him to us in a private matter, in manner, in only with his brothers, with his father, with Samuel, right? But the world has not seen David yet. The world does not know David yet. And so this chapter is going to introduce to the world and to Israel and to us today publicly God's chosen king. God's chosen king. And yet, if he's going to be such a king, he needs to prove that. He needs to pass a mission. You could say like 1 Samuel 13, where Saul had to pass a mission. David has a mission. He has a battle that he has to win. And he has to pass the mission so that he can show to the world that God is with him. Because as we're going to learn, David doesn't win the battle. God wins the battle. God has to show, he has to show that in reality, God is with him. He's trusting God. God is working in him. The battle is won. God is the winner. God is the giant slayer. You all have probably heard that song. How does it go? My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do. You have heard that, right? Okay, well, this chapter gives that song its theology. This chapter teaches you that my God is so big, my God is so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. There's no giant he cannot strike down. There's no stronghold he cannot break. There's nothing he cannot deliver us from. He is the real giant slayer. That's the point of the passage. And so, as I said, this chapter delineates for us a battle. A battle, and every battle is made up of fighters. And usually, fighters have really cool names. So let's outline our chapter today by the 3 fighters in the story. Start with fighter number 1, Goliath, comma, the metal giant. The metal giant. Look at verse 1 with me. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. And they camped between Soko and Azekah in Aphisdamim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them." So you have one army on one side, another army on the other side, and then a valley in between them where a mighty war is about to take place. And I want you to notice, guys, the way that the narrator is telling the story, he's setting the scene for this match that's about to make history, all right? It's almost as if he were saying, hey, guys, you got to sit back, you got to grab some popcorn and just enjoy the fight because this is going to be a good fight. But before we see the fight, we need to first be introduced to the fighters. And so the narrator becomes a boxing match announcer. I don't know what they're called. A boxing announcer. And so imagine, the narrator now takes the mic and he says, I think he's on the right side. On the right side, the Philistine's secret weapon, the Philistine's lucky charm and mighty champion, Goliath! And it goes wild, guys. It goes wild. Look at what happens. Then the champion, look at verse 4. Then the champion came out from the armies of the Philistines, named Goliath from Gath. And what we're about to read is supposed to intimidate you. It's supposed to intimidate you. So just imagine. I mean, Goliath is coming out, guys. This is a boxing match, a fighting match. Someone's going to die here, all right? So he's coming out. You can almost hear the rock music in boxing matches. And so he's like, he's coming out, and the crowd is going crazy. All right. Now, before we study Goliath's appearance, which is supposed to intimidate you, I want you to notice something in the word used to describe Goliath, all right? So notice this. He's called, in verse 4, their champion. And champion here, the word for champion here, literally means the man of the between. You should write that down. It's really important. The man of the between. And it refers to a warrior who stands between one army and another to rescue his people. Historically, such champions would place themselves in face-to-face combat, in duels against the chosen champion of the enemy's army. And if you won the battle, then your entire army won the battle. And if the other person won the battle, then they won the battle and you lost. And so rather than having a war, you would just choose your mightiest champions, your mightiest warriors, the men of the between, to stand there as a representative of his people. And so you could say that the man of the between is the representative of his people, the mediator of his people, the redeemer of his people, the savior of his people. I hope all of that rings a bell. So that's who Goliath is to the Philistines. And then the narrator begins to describe him for us as he's coming out to fight. Look at verse 4 again. It says, then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. That's almost 10 feet tall. I mean, this guy is a giant. This guy is humongous. He's 3 feet taller than Shaq, y'all. Like, you would try to look at the sun and you can't because his face blocks it. He's huge. That's the point. He's a giant. If he's a giant, then we need to ask a question. Where did he come from? So let me give you a short history of Goliath. If y'all remember, Numbers 13, Moses sent out spies to spy out the promised land. And when they got there, they came back terrified because what did they find in Canaan? Giants. Somebody said it. Giants. There you go. They found giants. And so all the spies, except two, came back trembling, saying, like, Moses, I know you're telling us to trust God, but you don't understand. The Nephilim are there. That's what they call them. The giants. And they're terrifying. They're humongous. They're going to take our daughters and our sons and our daughters and our wives. And we're like grasshoppers in front of them. Moses. And it was for that reason, because they did not trust God to deliver them from the giants, that God made them walk through the wilderness for 40 years. Because they feared giants more than they trusted God. And then we get to Joshua, and in Joshua 15, we see that once they have to take in possession of the land, Joshua begins to allot the land to different people. And in chapter 15, in verse 14, 45 years after the giant thing had happened with them, and after they had walked through the wilderness, we read this. Let me read it to you. Caleb drove out from there the children of Anak, the giants. So Caleb did this. And so Caleb drives these giants out of Canaan. And therefore, the giants who survived were now fugitives, confined to find refuge in certain Philistine cities nearby, one of which was Gath, which is where Goliath comes from. And so Goliath is a descendant of fugitive giants who were driven out from their homeland by Caleb in Joshua 15. Also, remember that Gath was one of the cities that suffered under the judgment of God when they were trying to pass around the ark. And so, you gotta understand, Goliath knows who the Jews are. There's history here. He's had beef with them since he was little. I mean, I bet he would have probably wondered his entire life, why is it that I live amongst midgets? Why do I live with the Philistines? Oh, it is because the people of God drove my family, my people, out of my home. So you got to understand, it may be that he's been waiting for this moment his entire life, for the moment when he can finally destroy the Jews. So he's not neutral here. Now let's keep going in the text. The narrator now begins to describe Goliath's armor. Verse 5. He, Goliath, had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of gold. This is a mail coat, sort of like the magic metal coat that Bilbo gave to Frodo. Only thing is that this is 126 pounds. Yeah. Verse 6. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and bronze javelin. A bronze javelin hung or slung between his shoulders. And notice the repetition, by the way. It's bronze, 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 bronze. This is a metal giant. That's the point. Verse 7. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, meaning his spear was so thick you couldn't even hold it with one hand. But he could because he was a giant. And then it says that the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's 15.1 pounds just for the head of the spear. And then lastly, we are told that his shield carrier also walked before him. So he has like 200 pounds of armor, of metal on him, and his shield is so heavy that another dude has to carry it around for him. And you should ask, well, what's the point of all of this? This is it, that he was terrifying. He was terrifying. Now let's look at what this metal giant had to say. Verse 8. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine?" Not by blood he wasn't. "And you servants of Saul?" Now notice this. "Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us." Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." "Pick a man," Goliath says. "Any man, your strongest man, your greatest man, your knight of knights and soldier of soldiers. Pick a man who will stand as the man of the between, who will fight me and deliver his people if he can. Pick your own mediator. Pick your own deliverer. Who will it be?" And if I may just say, that's what this book is screaming out for. And that's what the entire Bible is screaming out for. A man of the between who will stand not between us and Goliath, but between us and our greatest threat, the wrath of God. But to not get ahead of myself, look at how everyone responded in verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. How tragic. How tragic. And again, if the theme of our passage is that God is capable to destroy our giants, any giant, we need to come to this giant and say, man, can God take this giant down? Can God take this giant of giants, the epitome of a giant? Here he is. Can he take him down? And the answer is yes. Absolutely. Absolutely he can. And he's so powerful and so capable and so strong and so mighty that he's going to use the most improbable and unlikely of people to do so. And so we come to our second fighter in the story. Goliath has been presented in the ring, and then the narrator turns and says, "Now, for our second fighter, David!" And nobody claps. Nobody claps. In fact, the way he's described is so ironic in comparison to Goliath that I'm going to title this second fighter David, the Hobbit. David, the Hobbit. And so you have this insurmountable threat of death in the horizon, and then the narrator now moves us from the battlefield to the peaceful and humble and wonderful Shire. And there you spot him, the Hobbit who will save the day. And if he has a theme song for his boxing match, it would be the Shire song. You know it, right? It's like the most amazing song you've ever heard. How does it go? Aaron, you know it. That's it. Can you do it again so everybody can hear you? All right, give him a hand. Come on. That was amazing. If you have not heard that song, you need to. It's the best song ever made, ever composed. Anyways, that's his theme song. And so he walks in. Look at verse 12. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle, and the names of the 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. 14, David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. Now notice first of all that he's being introduced. David and his family are being introduced again, almost as if it was the first time, which is kind of weird since he was introduced to us in the last chapter, right? And not only that, but at the end of this chapter, we're going to find out that Saul doesn't even recognize David. And the reason for this is because most likely there's a break of a couple of years between chapter 16 and chapter 17. It may be that after chapter 16, Saul sent David back home, most likely because of the war. So he asks for David's brothers instead, sends back his harp player. And so it may be that now David has grown up to the point that he's not recognizable. So you could say that in chapter 16, he was a middle schooler, and now you could say a 17-year-old high schooler, okay? He's a high schooler. He's your age. Wow, this applies to you. That's amazing. All right. Now let's look at the circumstances that David had to face. Let's see. That is amazing. My notes just went crazy. So can you freeze for a second? Freeze. Pretend that this is not happening. You're still frozen? You're still frozen? All right. Look at 16. Unfreeze. All right. It says 16. The Philistine, Goliath, came forward morning and evening for 40 days. And took his stand. So for 40 days, guys. I mean, he's coming. He's having breakfast, coming out and saying the same thing. Give me a man. Then he has dinner, comes out again, and he says the same thing. Give me a man that we may fight for 40 days. And remember, 40 is the number of testing. So Israel's being tested right now. Will they trust God? And so Goliath keeps doing this, but Jesse and David would have had no idea about this because they're not in the battle. But it seems that Jesse seems to become anxious, perhaps, of his 3 sons, because look at what he says in verse 17. Then Jesse said to David, his son, take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. That's not what they were doing. They were afraid of Goliath. So essentially, he says, all right, David, go travel 15 miles, give these sandwiches to your brother, and bring news of them. And that, guys, is the setting that God is going to use to introduce David to the world as the man of the between, and ultimately as the future king. And isn't it amazing that David had no idea about it? He had no idea about it. He's just being faithful in his duties. That's all he's doing. And he's just letting God providentially bring about what he knew would happen. Later on, he would become king. He didn't know how. In the same way, he can do that for you. In what way, you may ask? Well, oftentimes people are constantly looking for ways to find their perfect opportunities, to open their perfect doors, to sell themselves and make their dreams come true. I don't know. Your duty, guys, is to be as faithful as possible, to be faithful in what God has called you to do, and God will providentially open those doors. And I see that in David. He's just simply being faithful in the small things. Verse 20, so David, it says, arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded. So he's not just faithful, he's obedient. And not only that, he's responsible and he's also humble, because David knew he was gonna be king. And he's not telling his dad and his brothers, listen, you fools, it's like, you better be careful. You better not get on my wrong side, because I'm going to be king, and one of these days I'm going to be able to send you to the dungeons. He doesn't do that. He's just humble, faithful in the little things. I keep reading the second half of verse 20. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. 23. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. And the moment that he heard them marked a turning point in redemptive history, in world history. History would never be the same again after this teenager heard Goliath's words. And as we begin studying verses 24 and 26, we are presented not only with how David responds to Goliath, but we're presented with a wonderful illustration, I think, of what it means to be a man after God's own heart. Listen, David is presented in these chapters, in these verses, in this chapter, as someone who had a different perspective than everybody else. He didn't see like everybody else. His mind was wired differently. He doesn't see as man sees, but he sees as God sees. Let's put it that way. If I could give you a summary of what it means to be a man after God's own heart in this chapter, it would be this. To be a man or a woman after God's own heart is to see as God sees. To have a heart that reflects God's heart. To see as God sees, to have a heart that reflects God's heart, to have a character that reflects God's character, God's nature. You love what God loves, you hate what God hates, you the glory of God is what drives you. Okay? There's a commentator that says that this chapter gives the illustration of the theology of chapter 16. In chapter 16, we learn that God does not see as man sees, for man looks at the physical appearance, God looks at the heart. And so we look at this chapter as we are introduced to David, and we see he doesn't see like everybody else. Everybody's looking at the physical appearance. David sees the heart. Let me show you. Look at verse 24. When all the men of Israel saw the man, Goliath, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. Again, they're looking at the physical appearance and fleeing. Verse 25, the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." 26, and David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine?" That's an insult, by the way. "That he should taunt the armies of the living God." The people answered him in accord with the same word, saying, "Thus it will be done for the man who kills him." All right, first of all, notice the difference between perspectives. In verse 25, the people called Goliath this man. And then verse 26, David calls him this uncircumcised Philistine. Verse 25, they call Goliath, they say Goliath comes up to defy Israel, it says. Well, in verse 26, David says that he taunts the armies of the living God. Do you see the perspectives? Verse 25, they speak of the man who kills him. Well, in verse 26, David speaks of the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel. Do you see the difference in perspectives? He's seeing, not as man sees. Everybody looks at his physical appearance. They're terrified. They're not seeing the greatness of God, but the greatness of this giant. And David is the opposite. Is a complete opposite. And that's also backed up by what happens in these verses. Essentially, David hears the offer of Saul. And Saul is basically telling everybody, hey, if whoever kills this giant, I will give them my daughter, which is messed up, by the way. I will give them riches, and I will give them taxes. It's like, you get the girl, you get the riches, you get no taxes. No taxes. And most 17-year-old dudes would be like, whoo, that's a deal. All right? But he doesn't do that. He does not do that. He does not do that. He hears both the reward of Saul. He hears the taunting of Goliath. And yet he responds opposite to everybody else. And he asks again about the reward of Saul, I think, because he doesn't understand why Saul has to put a bait for men to stand up and fight. It's almost as if he were saying, is there no reason to fight? Is there no reason to stand? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? To stand, is there no reason to stand? That reminds me of a couple of days ago, I was having lunch with a college student, and we were talking about how young people were made to stand for something and to stand against something else. And we were talking about all these political movements, whether right or wrong. I mean, it's amazing. We were saying how they're made up of young people. And he was like, why is it always young people? Well, because young people were made to stand for something. People were made to stand for something. You will stand for something. The problem comes when these young people are not informed on what to stand for, or they willingly choose to reject the truth, and therefore they stand for the wrong thing. Listen, you will stand for something. David is about to stand for the glory of God, and I hope you will too. Because what's life worth if you don't? Also, we're about to learn in a couple of verses that this war was ultimately a war between the gods of the Philistines and the God of Israel. And God was being mocked by Goliath, and David cannot stand it. How do you respond when God is being mocked? How do you respond to it? You hear it all the time in this world. Does that affect your heart in any way? David wrote later on, "Zeal for your house is eating me up. Zeal for your house consumes me. For your glory consumes you." Consumes him. Does zeal for his glory consume your heart? Is that what drives you? Do you ever have any sense of righteous indignation when you see the sin of the world, when you see the sin in your own heart? And you could say, how could Christ ever be so dishonored? There's this missionary. I think his name was Henry Martin. And he was a missionary in India. And after seeing the temples of India and the idolatry, he said this, "I cannot endure existence any longer if Christ will be so continually dishonored. I would rather die. Just die now than to keep beholding the dishonor of Christ." Is that your heart? Shows you what you value. I remember, like 7 years ago, there's this couple that played a big part in my life and in the life of Sarah, my wife. And 7 years ago, I was a baby Christian. I remember the lady in this couple, she came up to us at church. And man, she was broken. She was broken. And she told us that she had just found out that to say OMG and say God, the name God, the title God at the end, was blasphemy. And she was like, "I've been saying it every single day of my life, and I just found out it's blasphemy. How could I have dishonored the Lord all this time?" She was crying. She was so broken. Do you ever get broken because of the way you dishonor the Lord? Because of the brokenness of the sin, of the dishonor of God, of your God? You claim to be a Christian. Most of you would. Is that your heart? David saw as God sees. David's heart reflected God's heart. Does your heart reflect God's heart? Do you love what God loves? Do you hate what God hates? Do you hate it when God is dishonored? Do you trust the Lord when giants come, when problems come? Do you trust that he's good and he will protect you and he's with you? How do you respond to life? How do you respond to life? What is your greatest desire? Is it the glory of God? Verse 28. Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he, David, spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down?" Those are the same words that Goliath just said, by the way. "And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" He's like, those few sheep. He's like, "Listen, David, all you are is this, you're a nobody. You're just a shepherd boy, and you have all those few sheep. Where'd you leave them? You were responsible. Where are they? You're not even doing your job right." Keep reading. "I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." Again, just like everybody else, he's seeing as man sees. He's not looking at the heart, physical appearance. He was absolutely wrong. 29, but David said, "What have I done now? Was it not just a question?" And he turned away from him to another and said the same thing about Goliath. And the people answered the same thing as before. So David, he just brushes it off. He's like, I don't care what you say. And he just goes around, turns around, and keeps asking the same question. And it seems that he makes such a fuss about it. He's going around the camp to such a degree that it reaches the ear of King Saul, what David is saying. He's wondering. He's saying, why is nobody doing anything about Goliath? To the point that now the king is hearing about this young man. Look at 31. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul. And he sent for him. Again, I love this. This just shows his insistence, his intensity, his zeal. that everybody's hearing this young guy probably say, hey, you're not going to go fight, I'll go fight. To the point that Saul's like, all right, a warrior has come up. Bring him to me. And you would think, I mean, he's probably 16 or 17 years old. You would think that he would be shy in front of the king, but look what he says to Saul. Verse 32. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. This is funny. Saul hadn't even started talking. He just goes inside the tent of the king and he just starts commanding the king. King, don't you fear. And don't let the people fear. He's just taking charge. He's acting like a king. And then he says, your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. I love that. Again, he doesn't even ask for permission. He's saying, listen, man, I'm going to get the job because I'm going to get the job. I'm telling you I'm doing it. I'm not asking you. And you also, I want you to notice also that these words of David are the same words that Caleb and Joshua used to exhort the Israelites in Numbers when they were afraid of the giants. And these are the same words that Moses used to exhort Israel when they were afraid of Pharaoh. The point is, David knew his Bible. David is using biblical language. He knew his Bible. Not only did he know his Bible, he believed his Bible. Not only did he believe his Bible, he believed in the God of the Bible. He trusted in God. Now look at what Saul says, verse 33. Then Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth. Again, Saul sees like everybody else. He sees the physical appearance, not the heart. So he's just saying, man, you're a kid. You are a kid. You can't go. And notice, by the way, that this is a command. This is the king telling him, you cannot go. You're a kid. And because this is the king, that should have been it. I mean, there's probably a guard already walking towards David. Like, he's about to say, all right, kid. He said, no, get out. Get out. And most people would have been like, yes, your honor. But instead of that, David brings his resume. Verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. This is good. This is good. Most likely that happened when he was like 13 years old. This is a 13-year-old grabbing a lion by the mane or a bear by the beard and punching him to death. This is a man's man. Even though he would have been a kid. 36, your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistines. He's saying, please don't get me wrong, king. It's not me. It's not me who's going to do this. God will deliver me. There's no ounce of self-confidence in here, guys. This is God confidence. You need to have God confidence, not self-confidence. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that you have to walk around thinking that you're a worm or something, you know? No, you can be confident in the fact that you have skills that God gave you and allowed you to have. In the sense of, you can know, yes, I can get that job done because God is allowing me to. Ultimately, all the glory goes back to the Lord. Have God confidence, not self-confidence. Anyways, so after the insistence of David, look at how Saul responds. End of verse 37. Go, and may the Lord be with you, he says. And for a second, it seems that he's trusting in God. But then look at what he says in verse 38. Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. So essentially he says, go and may the Lord be with you. But let me give you my armor because I actually don't think that the Lord is with you. That's basically what he says. His words don't match what he's saying. There's no integrity in this guy. Verse 39, David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So he trusts his God. He knows He knows that his God is capable of delivering him, so he does not trust in Saul's armor. And that leads us to the final and most important fighter in the story, and it is this: Yahweh, the giant slayer. Yahweh, the giant slayer. Look at 41. It says, "Then the Philistine, Goliath, came on and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. The Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?'" He's offended. He's looking at David as an unworthy opponent. He's saying, there is no honor in killing a kid, basically. Give me a worthy opponent. Again, he's looking at the physical appearance, not the heart. And look at the end of verse 43. It says, "And the Philistine cursed David by his gods." Again, revealing that this war is between the gods of the Philistines and the God of the Jews, not between David and Goliath in the end. 44, "The Philistine also said to David, 'Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field.'" What's he trying to communicate to David? He's trying to communicate, listen, man, this is not a passive guy. He's about to break you. He will kill you, David. 45, "Then David said to the Philistine," and remember, guys, they're not 5 feet away from each other. This is a battlefield, all right? They're hearing each other. Their camps are hearing each other. They're screaming at each other. And so what David's about to say, he's screaming out from the top of his lungs. And there's a tenacity and anger and fury and passion in his eye. 45, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted.'" I love that. I love that. And by the way, this is the first time in the Bible that anybody claims to come in the name of the Lord, meaning he's saying, I am God's representative. You've been screaming out, crying out for a man of the between for Israel. Here I am. 46, "This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands." Notice the irony, by the way. David's calling Goliath a midget. Or like, you're so small that you're going to fit into my hand, Goliath. "And I will strike you down." And he's going to do that with stones, right? It's most likely, because this backs up again the idea that he knew his Bible very well, because in Leviticus 24, it says that anybody who blasphemes God had to be stoned to death. So it may be that David is thinking, Goliath, you blasphemed, and therefore you need to be stoned to death. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. "I will strike you down," he says, keep reading, "and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the armies of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth." I'm coming for you and your army, he says. And then he says why he's doing this. "That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Just beautiful. Just beautiful. Notice, by the way, that the last two fighters were introduced by the narrator, but now he allows David to introduce the third fighter, and that is God. This is God's battle, and he's about to show his power and might. Verse 48. "Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine." Notice, Goliath is just, he's approaching David, but David is running towards Goliath, and he's running as fast as possible. He's about to meet him. There is no going back now. And as David is running and running and running, look at verse 49. "David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground." I love that. Can you imagine the scene? There's a million paintings, guys. I like art. There's a million paintings where who try to which try to picture this scene, and I think they all get it wrong, or at least most of them. They always have David, all like a passive guy with a tiny sling, and he's like, boop, you know? That's not what's happening here. There's momentum here. It says that the stone sank into Goliath's forehead, meaning it pierced his skull like a bullet. Verse 50. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. Irony of ironies, the greatest warrior beheaded with his own sword by a hobbit. Keep reading at the end of verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sherem, even to Gath and Ekron. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. And wouldn't you say that this is a great ending? I think this sounds like a great ending. I mean, this would work very well. David defeated Goliath and the Philistines, and Israel defeated the Philistines, but that's not enough for David. David's not like, all right, my work is done. I'm going to go back home and play video games. He doesn't say that. He does not say that. No, his heart is pounding for the glory of God. So look at what he does in 54. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his weapons in his tent. He brought it to Jerusalem. This is very interesting because this is not the Jerusalem you know. The Jerusalem we know did not exist back then at this time. This was a Gentile, an enemy Gentile city. And so what you have here is this 17-year-old carrying by the hair with his bloody hands the Gaga ball-sized head of the fiercest enemy in town. And he's parading it around this enemy town. Why? He's trying to communicate something. He's saying, we're not afraid of you. But you should be afraid of us because we have the mighty God, and my God is so big, my God is so strong that he can defeat even the fiercest of warriors. So do not mess with us. Not only that, but he's also undoing the work of Saul. David had said that there was reproach on Israel. That reproach had been brought by Saul. He is undoing what Saul had done. He's acting like the king. By the way, the remaining passages, the remaining verses bring us back to Saul and the tragedy that he was. So look at verse 55. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this young man? And Abner said, by your life, O king, I do not know. The king said, you inquire whose son the youth is. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's hand, with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. So it's almost as if they were being introduced again. And the picture is that of an incompetent king who doesn't even remember the young man whom he loved to hear play the harp. And on the other side, this young, victorious king. Again, holding by the hair the head of the enemy of Israel. This is a sobering picture. You have an incompetent king who lost the kingdom and a victorious king who just gained it. For the very first time, we can say the king has arrived. Not the ultimate king, but the momentary king. This momentary king represents Christ, who is our man of the between, who is our mediator, who is our deliverer. Goliath represents your greatest of threats, sin, death, the wrath of God, the judgment that you deserve. And guess who you represent in this story? If there's anybody in the story that you represent, who would it be? What is it? You are the scared, frightened, cowardly Israelites trembling in the background because of Goliath. That's who you are. You need a deliverer. And then our deliverer shows up. Our men of the between, our champion, Christ, so that now he delivers us from our greatest problem. So that now we can say, oh, death, where's your sting? Oh, grave, where's your victory? I have salvation. I have salvation not because I'm David and I deliver myself, but because he paid the debt. He died for me. He is my champion. Isn't that amazing? And also, I told you that this, I guess the theme of our passage is, God is able to defeat all your giants. Do you believe that? Do you trust in him? Do you see as God sees? Do you see the way David saw? Do you truly say when giants come, when problems come, God is good. He is sovereign. He's working for my good and his glory. And that doesn't mean that he's going to defeat all of your giants in the sense that he's going to take all your problems away. No, it just means that he's good and he's working all things for your good and his glory. Do you trust that? Guys, if he already destroyed our greatest giant, damnation, why would we not trust him with any other giant this life brings us? So trust him first of all in salvation and then trust him for the rest of your life. Pray with me. Our God, you are so big and so strong and so mighty. We don't understand what that means. We have no idea what that means. And even when we get to heaven, we will not understand the infinity of your awesomeness. I ask you, please, that you would put in us a zeal for your glory, a burning desire like David had. If David could have this burning passion for you, why can't we not? Help us. Put a burning passion in us for your glory. Help us to trust you when problems arise, and help us to praise you because you have defeated something infinitely greater than Goliath for us. Thank you for being our champion, Lord Jesus, our man of the between. May we stand in awe of you. In Jesus' name. Amen.